This is House Einstein podcast number 6. I am your host, Osman Parvez, with House Einstein Real Estate here in Boulder, Colorado. And with me is Hamish Crabb.
Hello, hello.
All right. Well, today's topic of the podcast is homeowners associations. And this came to us as a topic of conversation because we have a client that's currently doing her due diligence in an association. And we also saw John Oliver's release about associations come out last week that was very spot on, although perhaps missing a few things too. Also very funny, as John Oliver often is. And so, hence the need to talk about due diligence and homeowners associations, in particular covering a lot of ground that was not covered by John Oliver. And I hope it is enlightening to our listening audience. If you're looking for us online, you'll find us at houseeinstein.com, and we are more than happy to work with you individually if you're buying or selling real estate. Here on the Front Range or in the mountains, we've got an amazing team, but that's not the intention of the podcast. The intention of this podcast is to have some fun, also to educate you about a lot of things that get overlooked in the real estate process and to help you make a smarter real estate decision. And when I first got started in real estate, it was after an investment career, working for investment companies. I don't know if I would call it a full career, but I had worked for a number of investment companies as an analyst and as an associate. And due diligence, in addition to financial modeling, was a large component of my work. And I was caught quite off guard by one of the first deals that went sideways for us that had an association problem. So first things first, if you are a client with House Einstein, you've signed a buyer agency agreement, and that tells you something very unique in that we will actually help you with your due diligence, including a discussion and research into associations. But ultimately, the buyer in Colorado is responsible for doing their own due diligence. And if you're not a client and you're just listening to this podcast, please treat it as entertainment. It's not legal advice and it's not real estate advice. And that's mostly CYA language so that we don't get into trouble with how litigious the world can be, and also keeping our attorney happy with how we're producing content. So yeah, I'll tell you the story. Yep. I mean, it's just the world we live in, right?
I was going to say there's a reason it's in the entertainment category on SoundCloud, right?
That's right. It's yeah. It's entertainment. Hopefully we're entertaining and educational for you. But here's how the first deal went sideways. So I'd already been doing real estate for about, oh, I don't know, 2 years? No, actually, no, this is longer because it was here in Boulder, not on Nantucket. And we had helped a client put a condo under contract. And this client was a contractor, was a handyman, also had just gotten his GC license and had been renting. And we found him something. And I want to say it was at Wimbledon, which is a development very close to CU. And we had gone through the whole contract process, which included the association deadlines. And the association deadlines are designed to allow a buyer to review the association documents and do their own due diligence on the association. And we had forwarded him the docs. He got the docs, but he didn't look at them. And we didn't look at them. And 2 weeks after closing, he was notified that he was in violation of the association because he had a dog. And he is an ethical person. He did not attempt to try to sneak the dog in under emotional support, make believe emotional support animal, or whatever fictitious attempt to bypass the HOA. He just contacted us and said, "What are we going to do?" And he said, "I've got to sell it. I can't live here if they don't allow dogs." And so even though we had not been technically at fault, I still felt really bad about that whole situation. And we went ahead and relisted the condo and sold it for him. And we did it at zero cost. And that enabled him, because we bought it right, And he got a good deal on it. We had negotiated a good deal. He did not lose a lot of money. My recollection, and this is so long ago, I'm not entirely sure, but my recollection is he broke even. It was not a horrible loss. We lost money in terms of time and effort and resources to market and relist this condo. I mean, in hindsight, given what's happened here in Boulder real estate over this time period, he should have done everything possible to hold on to this place, but he wasn't in a position to carry two properties. And so we did help him buy another one, which worked out well in the deal. But at the end of the day, I felt horrible that we had missed something so clearly obvious in the rules and regulations for the HOA. So after that, we started taking it a little bit more seriously and realized that even though it's not a duty of a real estate agent here in Colorado to their clients that are buying, we still can help our clients understand associations and not end up in a lot of trouble. So that's how I first learned how associations can really be problematic. I mean, most people think about the Karen problem, if you will, the nosy neighbor problem, the person who sits there with binoculars and looks for infractions and will then notify the association through the property manager that you left your trash cans out too long, and then they will come and fine you for that. Here in Colorado, I've never run into an HOA that is out of control, that is larger, but I have run into lots of situations where smaller HOAs are incredibly mismanaged. I mean, it's been shocking, and I've had more than one client, including one that's about to close, basically decide they have to take over the HOA to get anything done. And they get themselves elected to the board. They then push their friends that live in the neighborhood to also run. They get them elected, and finally they can make real change happen. But it's a really interesting problem because increasingly more and more homes are in associations, as John Oliver pointed out, that they're very hard to escape. There's also a whole bunch of plus sides to associations that I do want to talk about too. Hamish, I think you're currently in an association. Is that right?
Yeah, I am. I probably shouldn't name it, but I've got a few positives about this one and a few negatives too when we get around to it.
Okay. I think you had some run-ins.
Yeah.
I personally have not had a run-in, and I've lived in an association. And I'll tell you one of the most positive that I experienced, and I was very reluctant to buy this condo because of the association initially, and at the time it felt expensive, until the very first snowfall. And I'm sitting in this condo, it's snowing like crazy, and it's really cold out, and I make myself some coffee in the morning, and I sit at the window, it had kind of a window that overlooked the street below. And suddenly there's a group of people out there with snow shovels clearing the sidewalk. And having shoveled and dealt with snow removal myself, I mean, almost my whole life, I feel like my parents had me with a shovel at 10 years old. It just felt so nice to be in that warm, cozy space, sipping coffee and watching a team of people clear the snow. So there are some positives to being in an association, and exterior landscaping can be one of those. If there's litigation for some reason, like we had that same office condo complex had litigation over EFIS and construction defects. And I read the documents, but I didn't have to personally get involved in the litigation. I didn't have to personally go to the meetings because Boulder is a very smart place. They were very active people, very aggressive, proactive people, very intelligent in our community who took ownership and solved it and went to those meetings and hired the attorney to represent the association, sued the builder, which then triggered their insurance policy that got it covered. And we're talking about multi-million dollars builder liability, not association liability. But most people just worry about, you know, are the rules going to work? And most people worry about, are the dues affordable? It's the first question. How much are the HOA dues? Because it's all about a monthly payment, but they're not thinking in terms of what you're actually getting in services, and they're not thinking in terms of reserves. Hamish, are you familiar with how reserves work?
Somewhat. It's essentially kind of a disaster fund and maintenance upkeep fund, right?
Sort of. It's not really a disaster fund. It's designed, insurance is the disaster solution. Reserves are that as the property ages, there will be things that need to be replaced, and they're not part of normal operating costs. So a portion of your monthly due should be covering your operating costs, which is the majority of your monthly due payment. But then a slice of that, let's say 10%, 20% of that, should be funding a reserve. And in theory, that reserve should also be well invested, so it's getting, as in times like this, it's getting a return in interest too. And then when it comes time to paint the building, when it comes time to replace the bicycle parking or paint the parking lot, repave the parking lot, replace the roof, the association has enough money in its reserves to pay for it without sticking the owners with an unexpected special assessment because the roof needs to be replaced. So this is sort of like a piggy bank planning for the future. And it's not uncommon that owners fight increases in their dues. So to help organizations, more sizable organizations, plan, they hire a consultant to do a reserve study. I don't know what those consultants charge, but they put together an analysis of likely expenditures that are coming down the line, and they look at how that the cost increases are occurring through time, and then they make a judgment call on whether the association is adequately reserved or not. And that's one of the documents that you should be looking for when you buy a property in an association is, has there been a reserve study? And how adequately are we reserved for the future? What is the current funding level of the reserves? And it's so common that buyers just don't look at any of these things, right? They just, how much is the HOA due? So that's what they care the most about. But they don't think about what they're actually getting in services. They could be getting trash, snow removal, exterior maintenance, professional management of the complex. All of that should be, is often part of an association.
So when you have a consultant come out and get your reserve study, say there's an HOA that decides to do it in-house, you should still expect to see a reserve study in your association docs?
I feel like it's hit or miss. Really well-managed associations do a reserve study. Okay. But there are lots of associations that don't do one. So when we're shopping with a buyer, the first thing we look at is how well-maintained is this complex. And if there are visible and obvious signs of deferred maintenance, do we even need to go into the financials of the association to know that so far it doesn't look like they're on top of things? Now, it's possible that let's say it's worn out siding you see, it's possible they're planning to replace it this summer. And they actually are on top of things. But the first thing we look at is with our eyes. And so there's a couple of complexes in Northeast Boulder, for example, off of 30th Street, that often beg the question of how well maintained is this complex, because things start to look really run down. And not coincidentally, they have some of the cheapest association dues throughout the city of Boulder. And you look around, you're like, okay, it's looking kind of rough here. It's functional, but there's visible rust on the stairwells. The parking lot is a disaster. It's full of potholes. It looks like they've been patching the parking lot many times, but they haven't paved it. The paint is flaking around the exterior. All of those things are signs that the HOA is probably not in good shape. So there are multiple levels of due diligence. And the first level is use your eyes when we go shop. If you're my buyer, Hamish, and we're going to look at a condo or a townhome or even a detached house in an association, we're really looking carefully, not just at the individual unit, but also the whole complex, because it will help set expectations for what to see in the association docs. And then if you like the place, once we are under contract, there's a special section of the contract that deals with the association where the seller is required to give you the documents. And then you have a limited period of time to review those documents. But your association review should not be limited to the documents. You really should talk to people in the community and find out how aggressively are they, enforcing the rules. If you have a... Like, let's say you have a pit bull. Is there a rule against pit bulls? Let's say your investment thesis involves short-term renting it for 3 months every year while you go travel around Europe in the winter or in the summer. Is that allowed? And most associations don't allow you to do short-term rentals. Some associations don't allow dogs. They allow cats. Some allow no pets. So those types of rules we should try to find out even before you write the offer. If you have that type of circumstance, that's a hard issue that's not solvable. But then if you have something unique, usually we have to wait to get the association docs. And then you should be looking at the rules. You should be looking at the financial statements. There should be an income statement, and there should be a balance sheet at a minimum. If they're really on it, you'll see a cash flow statement too. You should also review the minutes of the HOA, which is the board meetings. And hopefully you can also get the contact information for a few of the board members, and you can call them. And you can ask them questions like, is there any pending litigation? Is there any litigation that's just been settled? Are there any unknown issues? Is there issues I should know about as a new homeowner before I buy? And then, of course, read the minutes, talk to the neighbors. And at the end of that experience, you will have an opinion about whether this association is acceptable to you or not. And that's all needs to be done before the association doc termination deadline. The deadline is actually just specific to the documents, but it really is a blanket deadline for the whole association. Because you can usually find something in the documents that relates to your issue anyway that you could point at and say that that's the reason I'm out. But the technical deadline at this time in the state of Colorado is the association doc termination deadline.
Is it one of those buyer's sole subjective discretion terms?
Yeah, and there's no resolution. So unlike a lot of the contingencies in the Colorado contract to buy and sell, there is a association termination deadline, but there's no there's no objection resolution process, because in all likelihood the association is not going to change their rules or change their financial policies just so that you will go buy a unit. So it's a binary event. It's a yes or no. Is this association acceptable to you in the contract? So fun stories about how it goes wrong. and there's more fun in that John Oliver podcast, which you definitely, I'm sorry, it's a video. You should definitely watch that video. Here's a really fun one. So we put a condo under contract in North Boulder, and this complex is directly north of where Tangerine is currently located off of 28th and, what's that street? Iris. Yeah, 28th and Iris. So there's that little complex. It has a number of restaurants. It has a golf tech shop. It has a whole bunch of things in there. And just north of there is this development. And there's a couple of different developments in that pocket. And my recollection is it was a sub-association of what's called a master association. I suspect these terms are going to change to be more politically acceptable going forward, but that's what they're called, a master association. And there's a subordinate association just for a handful of units. And this particular unit had storage in the title work, but was not in the listing description. And we knew every unit in the complex had a storage space. And we figured out that each of them are under the stairs for the unit. And our unit had a lock on it. And so we were under contract, and I contacted the listing agent and I said, hey, we'd like to see the storage unit under the stairs. And their answer was, what storage unit? This unit doesn't have storage. And we're looking through the title work. We're like, it's deeded. It's not just right to use it. You legally own it. And he said, you know, I guess you're going to have to contact the association to find it. So I did that. I found out who the president of the association was. It was like it's like an 8-unit association or something like that. And I contacted this person, and this person said to me, Osman, 15 years ago, I cleaned out that unit. Like, the previous owner or tenant left and left all their junk in the storage unit. And so I went into that storage unit and I cleaned it out. And ever since then, I've used it as mine. It's my storage unit now. And this is the president of the association. So I don't know if you can claim, it's not eminent domain, it's called adverse possession. I don't know if you can claim that over a storage unit or not. It certainly had not been the time that's required for adverse possession. So let me back up. Adverse possession is when you you claim a property as your own, and it's like squatter's rights. You've been using, openly and notoriously using something in without the owner's permission, right? So if you grant permission to somebody who is crossing your property on a trail, it's no longer adverse. But if they have been crossing it despite your no trespassing signs, they've been walking across it and they can prove it. I think the duration might be 25 years. We may want to look this up, but it's around two decades. It's a specific length of time. You can then use a court process to claim that as your own property. And she was implying that that's what she was going to do if we tried to kick her out of the storage unit. And my buyer just looked at this and is like, I don't want to join a sub-association with 8 units where the president has taken over my storage unit, and I've got to start off this relationship by kicking this person out. So let's just terminate. We'll go find a different property. And at this time, there were a lot more properties on the market. Like, this was not a desperation move. And so we moved on, and we explained why we were moving on to the listing agent. We terminated on the appropriate deadline, got the earnest money back for our buyer, and moved on. But it was an unbelievable behavior by the president of the association and their insistence that it belonged to them now.
What was the listing agent's reaction? Were they...
I mean, this was an agent, and this is a long time ago, but I didn't get the impression that they cared. They did a lot of business. They'll find another buyer who doesn't care about the storage unit. And there's a lot of agents like that. I mean, look, mostly agents are great. There's quite a few that are not. And this is a criticized by category, so I won't be naming this agent, but they weren't really vested in solving this. And I don't know if they ever did. We just moved on. We told them why we were terminating. They said, okay, see you later. They didn't try to solve it. They didn't engage, which is what I would have done. I would have said, hey, hold on. Let me talk to this president and see if we can try to work this out, because clearly she's in the wrong, this person who's squatting in your storage unit. Yeah. But they didn't do this, and we just moved on. So what other issues do people have with associations? Landscaping alterations, like fences. Usually, again, you can see this with your own eyes before you ask the question. So newer associations, even with detached single-family houses, won't let you put up tall fences in many cases. So what you'll see is a split rail fence, and you'll see chicken wire on the inside of it, which is to try to keep your pets in. Of course, if you have a dog that's a jumper, like I did growing up, that 4-foot split rail fence isn't going to do anything. So that can be a real problem for people with athletic dogs, so to speak. And again, your eyes are the first layer of due diligence. And once you're under contract, it's time to look really carefully at all those HOA docs, make the phone calls to the people on the board, talk to the community members, and get a better sense of what's it like living under the rules of this association. You're joining a financial club. It's like you're marrying somebody, and you really need to know before you get to the altar what's their credit history and what's their spending behavior and what are their drug habits. Like, you really kind of want to do some due diligence here on this club, because once you're in the club, there's no getting out. And the last thing you want to have happen is be surprised that you have a special assessment, because all the roofs need to be replaced. And it's a special assessment that now falls to you because it came after the contract closed. And it wasn't disclosed, or maybe it was disclosed and you missed it, and even if it was disclosed and you missed it, or say it wasn't disclosed, and it's actually the seller's duty. So there's a whole bunch of check boxes in the contract that talks about special assessments. Good luck getting the seller to pay for a special assessment once they're gone. Like, you're going to have to hire an attorney and chase them. After closing, it's very difficult and expensive to get people to be accountable. Because there's no leverage in the deal anymore. The deal closed, and your agent's not liable. You are. So special assessments are something to pay a lot of attention to know what to expect in the near future. The rules. You need to look for reserves, pending litigation, and you also need to understand how alterations are made. So even though there's no association, there are sometimes rules that are a covenant recorded in the title work. This is another story.
This is interesting, though. No, I like this one. Yeah.
So this one is right here in the city of Boulder. There's this Alpine Balsam Peninsula that overlooks, I call it the Alpine Balsam Peninsula. From a geology perspective, it looks like a continuation of Valmont Butte. So Valmont Butte, if you follow that line from Valmont Butte, it goes right to this line. It goes right from the Alpine Balsam Peninsula. It then goes in and panorama. It then goes over to Sunset Hill and then drops back down past Casey Middle School. So that's this location. And whoever developed the homes originally in that location on Panorama and on Alpine and Balsam, I don't know if it was the same developer, but one of the homes we put under contract, while we were doing our inspection, the neighbor walked over. And this home that my clients bought has an incredible view from both the yard and the backyard and the first floor. It's a ranch-style house with a basement, so it's a one-story house with a basement. And the decks are incredible. I mean, it has some of the best views for any property I've sold in Boulder. Just jaw-dropping views, other than the power lines, which is a whole other topic for that spot. While we're doing our inspection, the neighbor walks over and says, "Oh, did the listing agent mention that there are rules that prohibit owners from going up and blocking the view of the people behind them?" And my client wasn't thinking about going up, but he's very investment savvy. And that was part of our initial review of this house. Like, the views are jaw-dropping now. Imagine if you put a second-story primary suite on this house. What would it be like then? Like, we clearly saw upside potential in the long term for this location. And this guy came over and said, "Just so you know, you're never going to be allowed to go up because there's this design review thing, and it's not going to be approved."
And we're like, "That's baked into the title work?"
It's baked. So it was recorded at the time of the original subdivision that the original developer and a committee, which I can only guess was comprised of this person's drinking buddies or golf buddies that also bought in the neighborhood or other investors, this committee would have subjective, arbitrary approval of any significant alterations of these homes, especially with regard to heights. And that was indeed in the title work. Now, here was the problem. The original developer was dead, and all of the design committee people were dead. Nobody that was mentioned in the title work was alive, and this process still existed. And this is where real estate agents, when they are in water that's too deep for their knowledge and experience, are supposed to self-regulate. They're supposed to say, "Hey, I don't have the knowledge and experience to give you professional advice on what to do here. This is who I would call." And that's what I did. I said, here's the name and number of our attorney that we recommend. They are the 800-pound gorillas of attorneys here in Colorado when it comes to real estate. You should go with them. They are solid. We trust their advice. And so my client did that. He engaged them. We delayed the whole, we amended the contract to allow more time to understand this issue. The seller agreed to that. And the attorney eventually said to, or the advice out of the attorney was, "Look, it's an extremely unlikely thing that if you're making an alteration that does not block the view of your neighbor, that there's going to be any objection. If you make an alteration that's going to block or damage or impinge on the view of your neighbor, this mechanism could be something that they could litigate over. And the only reasonable way to avoid that litigation entirely is to notify the entire neighborhood of your design plan and collect objections." Well, this is the city of Boulder. Right. If you send out a certified piece of mail to every single one of your neighbors in a subdivision and say, "Do any of you object?" Of course people are going to object. You're just inviting objection. You're just inviting people to light their torches and show up on the front door or at the permit office and complain and resist your development. So that's not really a reasonable course of action. And the neighbor does have a mechanism to fight you if you do something that blocks their view. And at the end of the day, that was the conclusion, but it didn't stop my client from buying. We got we negotiated a fantastic deal on that house. We got the seller to fix a bunch of things in the inspection process that were significant. And it's been an incredible investment for my client, but he's lived there. He hasn't moved ever since. But at least he knew going in, right? This was not a surprise after closing. This was not after he hired an architect and a builder to have the neighbor show up with a lawyer saying, "You got to stop." He knew going in. And that was doing our job, was helping our client reach that point. Although, again, and I'll say this one more time, ultimately the buyer is responsible for this due diligence. But if you are one of our clients, we will do everything we can to help you. We will do our best to help you get the documents you need, think about these things in the future, Let's say you want to start a contracting company of your own, and you want your own branded fleet of plumbing trucks. Well, guess what? Most associations don't allow you to park a commercial vehicle every day at your house. So you have to leave your commercial vehicle at your plumbing office and not bring it home. If you live in an association with rules against commercial vehicles, rules against RVs, does an adventure van count? Well, let's look to see how many adventure vans are in the neighborhood. That'll answer your question really fast. We were in especially Boulder. We were in Gun Barrel, which is a neighborhood here in Boulder, about a month ago with a client, and we've been trying to figure out, well, one of the list of questions, I wouldn't say this is at the top of the list, was will they allow people to park their trailers in a driveway? Because this client owns a relatively small travel trailer. And as we're driving away from a showing, there's an Airstream in somebody's driveway, which is, you know, a shiny silver RV, and the door's open in the Airstream, and the owner's working on things. And so I just pulled over, and we got out of the car. And of course, you're approaching somebody strangely from the street, and I'm like, calm down, don't fear me, please don't shoot me.
Like,
I just want
to
ask you about
a dog, right?
Yeah, well, it's unexpected, right? And this person, I mean, not to gender stereotype, but this is a female, and she's older, and I'm a tall, dark-skinned human being. And, you know, like, I understand that there could be fear, right? That's stereotypical, it's implicit bias, whatever. This is the world we live in. I don't want to get shot. So I'm being really careful approaching this lady, and I say to her, can I ask you, I'm a realtor, I'm showing houses, and my client has an RV, and I just wanted to ask you, can we talk to you about the RV rules? And she was super friendly after that, when she realized what we were asking about. Of course, she asked me if we knew one of her favorite realtor, which we do. He's a very top realtor here in Boulder, so that helped that we knew him. And then she said, yeah, well, so basically, no one complains if you've got an RV in your driveway for a day or two, but it can't live there. So if you're preparing for a trip and you bring your RV into your driveway, so far, so good. There have not been any issues, but the neighborhood does have rules about long-term parking of recreational vehicles in the neighborhood, and this is in the country club neighborhoods in Gun Barrel. And Gun Barrel, by the way, has a couple different pockets. It's not all of Gun Barrel. This is just that country club zone.
So, quick circle back, I guess. When we were talking about that earlier neighborhood with the height restrictions, would that be similar to... you have a seller that did a bunch of unpermitted work, would you then be liable if you were to purchase the house after it have the top popped to the kind of recourse there?
Well, that's a legal question, Hamish. So basically what you're describing is you bought a house from somebody that did the work.
Yeah.
And that you've closed on the house, and 6 months later, the neighbor that was living behind you comes over and says, hey, I've been out of town, and it looks like you built a second story that blocks my view, and I'm going to now sue you to take that down because you violated the rules. You know, I'm not qualified to answer whether you got a case or not.
Opens you up.
You could have a problem.
Yeah.
Well, if you're buying a spec home that's newly constructed with a second story, it certainly should be a question, was that second story allowed under HOA rules? Because the permitting office which is here in the city of Boulder or in the county, the ones that issue permits, building permits, are not reviewing the association. They're not reviewing association rules, and they're almost certainly not going through the title record to look for a design review committee that died out 30 years ago. So I think you could have a problem there, and probably they won't force you to deconstruct. Although that has happened to people in Colorado, in Boulder in particular, they more likely will look for some sort of financial compensation for the loss of their view.
And it could also be steep.
It could also be steep. So you should always read your title docs very carefully. And you should click all the links and make sure that when you get that commitment from the title company, you have clicked all of those links and at least scanned them. It's not uncommon that they send you wrong documentation. We just had that for one of our closings where the links are on the wrong properties. And I didn't catch it. My client did. They're like, these docs that are linked are completely wrong. Title companies also make mistakes. Another one just made a mistake by double charging our client for a $1,500 credit. I missed it because I was just scanning it quickly to see if the big picture looked right, and I didn't realize they had charged twice for the same credit. He caught it. I really appreciate that he did, and also a little embarrassed I didn't. But
you won't next time.
I'll look more carefully for sure. I mean, I definitely pay attention to purchase price, amendments, commissions. There's some things we have no control over, like lender fees that are tacked on, but I do notice them when a lender is really taking my client to the cleaners. But they agreed on that lender. They paid for whatever they're getting, the points or maybe additional service fees. I'm not sure what these loan fees are, but they agreed to them. And those are extremely well disclosed in the real estate process. But mistakes also still occur on things like commissions. And if the agent is crediting, like we credited our seller recently on inspection and photography, because we used he paid for the photography. Normally, that's a realtor cost. And we are willing to pay for pre-sale inspections all day long because of the benefit they have to the transaction. So I needed to credit him back for those things. But it would have been easy to miss it. So, review your title work, review your title commitment, and even more importantly, talk to the neighbors. Like, this is another topic for due diligence. But if you start talking to the neighbors, you ring the doorbells, you get a sense, you have a list of questions, just let them know you're thinking about buying the house next door, or maybe you're already under contract, which is the better time to do it usually. And say, I just wanted to see what you thought of the neighborhood. Are there any issues I should know about with the association? How's it like living here? How hard do they enforce the rules? Are the trash bins, they need to be back in my garage in 15 minutes? What if they're visible from the street? Does anybody care? And you will often learn a lot about the house too. You can ask about the house. Do you know anything about the house? I had a deal, Hamish. Well, this is after 2013, so it must have been like 2015, 2016, and it's in Martin Acres. It's a tri-level, and there's no disclosure of any flood damage on the seller's property disclosure. And we do the neighborhood thing, right? We're under contract, the inspection's going on, and we start walking around talking to the neighbors. And one of the neighbors disclosed that not only was there flood damage, he knows for sure because he saw water pouring out of the house and there were tons of sandbags in the driveway to try to direct the water away. And we're like, okay, well, that's not comfortable. So we called the listing agent. I called the listing agent. I said, what the heck's going on? He's like, I don't know. I didn't know anything about flood damage. And by the way, realtors in the state of Colorado, real estate agents that are licensees, are proactively required to disclose defects in the property. So his cover was, I didn't know. Okay. And when he contacted the seller, she claimed that she didn't think that was a flood.
Right. The 2013 floods.
I guess there was no Noah's Ark and pairs of animals involved, but for some reason, she did not think that water running into her house from the surface and destroying, well, maybe not just damaging the first floor of her house constituted a flood. In her mind, maybe, you know, she could see like a river of water and her house floating away. That's a flood, but not water coming in from the street. In any event, we terminated because the buyer's perspective was, if the seller is going to lie about flood damage, what else are they lying about? And he just couldn't take the risk. So we killed that deal for him and got him his earnest money back because it occurred during the inspection period.
Well, thank you, neighbor.
Yeah, thank you, neighbor, well, I mean, I'm sure the seller was like, thank you, neighbor, for killing my deal. But from my perspective, we did our job. Like, yep. Our job is to assist our client in property selection, right? Guide them to finding homes that really meet their needs and help them avoid really common pitfalls that are visible and obvious to us. I mean, after doing this for 20 years, we walk into a house and you really can see things that some people it's just not on their radar. And there's so much easy due diligence just in that first visit, that with your eyes and your nose. And then if we find a deal killer, like the neighbors lying about the disclosures, we do so before we run out the clock on that particular contingency. And there's no contingency for my seller is a liar. Yeah. Although you could say that they're acting in bad faith and the contract has specific language around bad faith. But you probably are going to find yourself in a dispute over the earnest money. If you discovered that the day before closing, you know, I think it would be a dispute. and you probably would get your earnest money back, but maybe not guaranteed. But if you terminate during the inspection period, it's such a blanket exit. We got the earnest money back without a problem. So this is why you want to do most of your due diligence before the end of the inspection period, and certainly all of your due diligence on the association, if there is one, before the association doc termination deadline.
On the note of pre-inspections and disclosures as a whole, what's your kind of opinion on if you have HOA docs available to you on this listing that you're about to publish? Do you want to have that before you potentially go under contract? You know, do you want that in your supplements on the listing, or is there a general strategy for that?
Yeah, I've almost never seen it organized in a zip folder and available before writing contracts. Most agents wait until you're under contract to then get the association docs. A sign of a good agent is when they're asking about the association before you list the property, and are assembling or helping you assemble that archive of documents, or even better, are just asking for your username and password if it's not on a public site. And often association docs are not on a public site. So unfortunately, it's not common is my answer. And would it help you to make it common? Like if you were the seller and you wanted to practice clear, complete, proactive disclosure, making sure your listing agent has these documents and has provided them to buyers, you could do that. And I'll tell you, there isn't actually a competitive advantage to doing that. So let's say you're on the buy side and you can find these documents early. In a bidding war, you can remove the contingency associated with the association. You can just waive it, right? And now your contract, so the more things you take off the table in a negotiation in a competitive environment, the more risk factors you take off the deal for the seller, the more likely they are to take your offer. So you could waive inspection entirely, although we never recommend that. You could. I have and been burned personally on my own purchases. I waived it because I knew it would win the bidding war. And then I discovered the furnace is bad, the sewer line is bad. I mean, we knew it needed a lot, but there were a few surprises in that house. You could, in a competitive environment, get copies of the association docs early and thereby waive the contingency. And that will make your offer stronger without changing the price. But the problem is that the listing side is often not prepared to give you the association docs ahead of time. So your agent, me, if I'm representing you as a buyer, has to aggressively push to get those docs. And sometimes it's just not possible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yep, great question. See, did we miss anything? We talked about commercial vehicles. Oh, vehicle maintenance, that's another item. So Hamish and I, as we've mentioned before, are both car guys. We like vehicles. And one of the things that both of us do is some degree of vehicle maintenance. And most associations have rules about vehicle maintenance in the driveway. And what they're trying to avoid is somebody putting their vehicle up on blocks and leaving it out front for months at a time. But usually it's a blanket, not allowed. So that means as simple as an oil change you shouldn't be doing in the driveway. And if you've got a nosy neighbor that wants to penalize you with the binoculars and report you, well, all it takes is a digital photo and an email, and you're going to be hit with a fine.
Yeah.
Or worse.
Even car covers I've seen in some areas, which is an interesting one.
Yep.
I was fortunate enough to have my car on jack stands for probably a good week and a half before I got it off. But it was, you know, kind of concerning each day, you know, am I going to get a call?
What were you doing?
Oh, this was stripped out a bolt in the timing case of my car and didn't have anything to do with it. Like, you know, couldn't fix it immediately and just kind of sat there for a little bit.
Yeah, HOAs are quite funny in how they run. Not all of them, by the way, run for conformity. So certain HOAs, like the ones in Rock Creek and Superior, really want paint colors the same. And they're very aggressive on noticing when your paint is deteriorating. They will get on you. I had a closing that the buyer was notified weeks 2 weeks after closing that the house needs to be completely repainted. And it didn't look that bad, but not according to the HOA. It was ready. So that's I mean, in some ways it's cool, right? Because if you're the neighbor and you own an adjacent house, you know you're not going to get a derelict-looking house in front of you that has decades of deferred maintenance. So homes in associations tend to actually have higher values than homes that are not in associations, all things being the same, all other things being the same. But some associations actually, like Prospect in Longmont, encourage diversity. So if you're repainting your house, they don't want you to paint the house the same color as the neighbor. And I don't know if that's a hard rule or a guideline. The last time I looked at the Prospect rules, but I was kind of surprised by it. So in other words, if your neighbor has a fuchsia house, which they're fine with in Prospect because they love diversity of architectural styles and colors, you are not allowed, or you should not, and again, I'm not sure if it's a hard rule or a guideline, they strongly discourage you from painting your house the same color because they want the neighborhood to feel more eclectic and architecturally interesting. And that's what you see in Prospect. When they first built that neighborhood, a new phase is about to begin, by the way, but when they first built that neighborhood, when the trees were just planted, there was a lot of scratching of heads and polarized reactions. People either loved it or they hated it. But today, the perspective is much more universally positive. It feels, I mean, it's unlike any other neighborhood in Boulder County that I've seen. And I look forward to seeing what they do with the second phase, finally, now that that's in the works.
Yeah, it's working for them, that's for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. If you did the median value in Prospect on a dollar per square foot, and you compared that with any other neighborhood, except for maybe the historical downtown area of Longmont, Prospect is going to be off the charts compared to everything else. And for good reason. It's not just unique houses. It's the community, the culture of community. They used to do food trucks. They still have restaurants and shops in the neighborhood. It was designed with all of that in mind from the beginning. And I think they killed it. It really... If I was going to personally buy in Longmont, it would be two areas. It would be Old Town or Prospect. And Prospect probably would come up top because it's easier to get to Boulder from Prospect. It's only 15 to 20 minutes.
On the diagonal, right?
Yeah, let's call it 20. If there's no traffic and there's no snow and no rain. And the diagonal is not exactly a fun drive. Yeah. It may get better with time, but that's... That is part of the downside. You still get a big discount to compared to the city of Boulder, though, for Prospect. Yep. Yeah. So let's see. Did we forget anything else that we need to talk about? We're coming up on an hour, which is really our target length for the podcast. And this is our third rejuvenated podcast. It's now distributing on all the places podcasts go. And I think that we're going to continue because it keeps us on track. It keeps us in line with our mission, which is to help educate our buyers and sellers and others that may be considering hiring a real estate agent here in Colorado. We have an amazing team, as I mentioned before. We'd love to represent buyers and we'd love to represent you, dear listener. Check out our website at houseeinstein.com. And we look forward to seeing you again soon.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.
All right. Thanks so much. Okay, take care. Bye.